views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of 55KRC, The Talk Station, and Clear Channel Worldwide.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, Cincinnati's only gun talk show. Join us. We're going to explore the topic of firearms and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Now here's your host, John Johnston, on 55KRZ, The Talk Station.
Good evening and welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. I'm your host, a very, very tired John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to best shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me this evening, as always, Mr. Andy Ulrich. Andy, how's it going?
Fine. I'm probably more rested than you are.
I would assume so. For those that don't know, it was SHOT Show 2014 this week out in Las Vegas. I literally just drove straight through from Las Vegas, 32 hours with stops only to get gas and switch drivers. So made it here about 20 minutes ago, which is great because we have a really, really excellent guest this evening, Mr. Kyle DeFore, who, if some of you who are not familiar with his background, Kyle was a member of the Naval Special Warfare Community, and I will let him talk more about that. Does all sorts of training these days, all sorts of interesting things that I am looking forward to talk about. So, just a couple of announcements real quick. When I was out at SHOT, I got to finalize a couple of deals. So, first one being, I'm going to be shooting a Knights Armament SR-15 E3 IWS Mod 2, which is their brand new rifle. I'm going to be putting 20,000 rounds of M855 and SS-109 through that this coming year, which is going to be really, really cool, and I'm really very thankful for the opportunity to do that. Also going to be doing a long-term endurance test on F&H's new FNS 9mm 5-inch long slide striker-fired pistol, which should be really cool, and I'm, once again, honored to be doing that as well. So you guys will get to hear more about that as the year progresses, and I'll be posting updates on the website and also online at Facebook, which is a good reason to check out Facebook. So what else have we got going on? Oh, the Salient Mark 25. Actually finished that up at the show. We put another 50 rounds through it. Chris Costa put, I want to say, 30 through it, and I put 20 through it. So final round count on that was 25,104. And Cry Precision was nice enough to auction that off for us at their silent auction that they do every year. And we raised about $6,000, actually. For the Unit Scholarship Fund and also the Navy SEAL Foundation. So I'm very, very glad to be part of that and very glad that I decided not to keep it. Though there was a large part of me that wanted to because, man, that was a nice gun. But it's really, in my mind, everyone's responsibility to try and help out whenever they can. And that was the best way I could come up with doing that. But hey, no one had to tell me that I had to help out. See, right. We just did it because that's what people do. You don't need someone telling you to.
Right.
Sorry, I'm getting semi-political here since I'm tired and I usually don't. But anyway, we'll get on to stuff that people actually care about, which is going to be Mr. DeFore and talking to him. So without further ado, we have Mr. Kyle DeFore joining us this evening. Kyle, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, man, I'm good. How are you guys?
Oh, pretty good. I made it on time, so hey, we didn't have to go to Plan B. So, and Andy, you should be happy we didn't go to Plan B, because Kyle and I had come up with something good, but it doesn't matter now. So.
It would involve me somehow?
Oh, yes, it would have involved you somehow. Right. So, anyway.
That's what you do in your early days of this industry. You have to drive everywhere and eat beanie weenies.
Oh, so, yeah. It was actually nice because people kept buying me meals. It was more of I had to drive out there because I had 25,000 rounds of brass I needed to give back to the people that had given it to me.
You didn't need any Stuckey's nut logs on the way out there, did you?
No, I didn't. Are we allowed to say that on air? I don't think we're
sure. I've eaten many a Stuckey's nut logs.
Wow, I'm way too tired. Anyway, let's get back to important stuff. Sorry, Kyle. I'm a little goofy right now. So for those that don't know, can you discuss your background a little bit, and we'll go from there?
Yeah, I was Right now, I'll kind of go backwards maybe.
Sure.
I run DeFore Performance Shooting. We're entering our fifth year. And about 90% of my business is military, government, LE contracts. And I got a slew of dudes that work for me. Some of them are from my old place and other places that are around, and all very experienced dudes. And, you know, everything's going good, man. I can't complain. Living the dream.
Perfect.
Before this, 1 year at Tiger Swan, a couple of buddies of mine that owned Tiger Swan, they made me an offer. And so I worked there for a year, and I got the opportunity to start my own thing through some contacts that I had. So that's what I did. And the 5 years before that, that would have been like 04 to 09, I was the head instructor at Blackwater for firearms and tactics. So that's where I kind of, you know, I used Eric Prince's money to make all my mistakes, is what I tell everybody.
Yes.
I kind of learned, you know, you don't really know what you're doing in this industry until you make a lot of mistakes, in both shooting and designing courses and whatnot. And so that's what I did. And before that, I was a member of Naval Special Warfare Development Group, and had a real good time there. And forward deployed to Afghanistan in support of OEF.
Well, thank you very much for your service.
Oh, my pleasure. It was a good time. And you know, worked as a sniper and an assaulter. And previous to that, I was a sniper at SEAL Team 8. And you know, before that, I was in high school. So.
Well, there you go. So you've been doing this for a while now, and you've been a professional shooter one way or another for most of your adult life.
Yeah, I mean, came in the Navy. You know, got through BUDS in '94, '95. So, yeah, I mean, we're touching on 20 years. But you know, I would say I'm a way better shooter now than I was in the teams. I know that sounds weird to a lot of people, but you know, you have to hang out with a mix of people until you kind of realize what good is and what it isn't.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, been doing it for a good amount of years now. And, hey man, it's better than having a real job, I'll tell you that.
Isn't it? Yeah, I'm slowly discovering that it's not too bad. Now we've got about a minute and a half left, and I guess we'll kind of touch on this briefly, and then we'll get more into it when we come back from the break. We're talking with Kyle DeFore from Proformance Shooting. So I'm curious as far as now you've got your own set of standards that you use. And there are other standards that are around as far as, like, you know, the Hackathorn standards or even the Rogers Shooting School. I'm curious your thoughts as to how much shooting the standards actually prepares you for getting in an actual shooting. We've got about 55 seconds left, so we'll probably pause you halfway through this.
Yeah, you know, that's one we get a lot. And, you know, not just me, but everybody. You have to have some type of scale to score yourself on. And that scale needs to be difficult for you as an individual in your training. You know what I mean? You got to have it. Now, how much does the Hackathorn standards prepare you for a pistol gunfight? You know, I mean, it may or may not. I mean, are you ever going to have three people you're going to shoot, you know, that are a yard apart? Probably never going to happen.
Right.
But, you know, what it does is it hits every aspect of weapons manipulation for the most part. It hits things that are done under pressure in front of people. It hits tiny shooting zones, which, you know, we need to concentrate on in real world stuff. And
right. I'll actually interrupt real quick just because we came up on that break. But when we get back, we'll delve into that a little bit further. Right now, we're talking with Kyle DeFore. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. So, before the commercial break, we were talking with Mr. Kyle DeFore from DeFore Performance Shooting about standards and whether or not they actually prepare us for a real-life situation. Kyle, are you still there?
Yeah, perfect. Still here, man.
So, we'll continue that. You were saying that, you know, while the likelihood of having to shoot three attackers that are 1 yard apart is very slim, it does force us to do some other things that are good practice as far as getting in the habit of doing these?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we take a timer and scoring rings into the equation, you know, what we're doing is we're working with to get guys to work under stress. You know, that's what we call the, in my thing, the very early stages of stress, you know, the timer and scoring rings. And what I found over the years is that, generally speaking, and I'm not pulling this out of, you know where. I mean, this is one thing that I'm very lucky at to this day is that the majority of my students, and I use that word loosely because I like to tell people they don't really, you know, they're not training under me, they're training with me. But the people that I shoot with, I get direct feedback from them. You know, from Afghanistan, Iraq, the streets here in America, you know. So what I found is that when you get a guy who is, you know, you brought up like the hackathon or whatever, if you get a guy who's somewhere around 80% on pretty much any standard that I've seen, and I mean I've pretty much shut them all, you know, somewhere around that 80% mark, if we can get a guy hanging in there, dramatically better results during real world engagements. I mean, like astronomically better.
Right.
And then what I've been adding to that with me and my crew in the past few years is we've kind of, you know, I'm not going to say it's like some secret sauce or whatever. I mean, people kind of know what we're doing a little bit, but we're inducing stress in other methods rather than just running and getting a high heart rate. And,
right.
And we're just having huge, huge success. And I should say that we're having huge success on first encounters. And I'm talking about like a cop in the U.S. who is getting into his very first gunfight ever.
Right.
We're having big success there, whereas before we're talking about the average is a 50% hit ratio. You know, if he fires 10 rounds, he hits 5 times. You know, now we're hovering somewhere around 7 or 8 hits out of 10. And I'm pulling that number out. That might not be it. It may be 4 rounds, and it may be 3 out of 4, whatever.
Right. Significantly better results, though.
Significantly better. And then what's happening with the guys overseas is that, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, it depends on which side of the fence, what your mindset is like. But, you know, they're getting to really practice this, you know, on an average of every other night or every other 2 nights.
Right.
And, you know, they're telling us that, you know, basically the stuff we're doing is exactly like it is for the cops here, but now they're getting to practice it so much that after the first 2 or 3, and that generally is the number, it's the first, you know, some guys say 2, some guys say 3, you know, it just becomes a routine for them. It's
right.
Just a, you know, it's like taking the trash out, you know.
Yeah, and it was, I've had this conversation a couple times now with people, but turning gunfights into shootings for the good guys is always a good thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, as far as making a routine. Now, I'm curious as far as, I guess, your thoughts on adding stress and measuring performance and tracking that sort of thing. Do you think, I mean, is that like the big key component, though, with whatever we're doing is to add the stress so that when you're actually experiencing a large amount of stress, it's not as foreign to you?
Yeah, but, you know, here's what I found out over the years. And, again, I've made mistakes along the way. You know, early on, I was of the opinion that if I could get a guy with a high heart rate, you know, and generally speaking, this is different for everybody, but for the most part, for talking points here, if we can get him around 160 to 170 beats per minute, and he can still actually engage and see sights, meaning that we can have him shoot at distance and up close.
Mm-hmm.
I used to think, okay, he's going to rock it. This guy's good. What we kind of, and this was kind of a, where I missed it is because of where I came from, just the nature of the selection courses and whatnot. I did not account for the fact that where I used to work at, you know, in the Navy, it's a little bit different. And so what I had to start doing was kind of trying to make guys almost feel this extreme amount of stress, and to induce that, I went through, you know, I mean, you know, we went through, it was a rigmarole. I mean, we started out doing all kinds of wackiness, and it wasn't working, and we've kind of, I got with, you know, my buddy Tom Kyer from the PSYOC crew, and we've kind of, I think we've broken the code now,
yeah.
But, you know, I would say that you know, half of it is definitely the stress inoculation. You have to get the heart rate to a certain degree, but here's the important part is that you have to make guys feel that adrenaline dump that they can only feel through certain stimuluses.
Okay.
And, you know, this is not for a lot of people. I mean, you know, I've gone places and people are like, hey, man, we're not doing this. And I've gone to other places and I make a living off of going to these places.
Right.
So
right.
Not for everybody. And let me throw one other thing in there is that I will tell you that combined all that with what we've talked about so far, and I'll tell you the number one thing that most people that I would say are probably listening to this broadcast can do, straight up weapons manipulation.
Okay.
I mean, people ask me all the time, what's the difference between a tier one shooter and everybody else? And I will tell you that a huge part of it is weapons manipulation. They can do it anywhere, anytime, in any condition. And so, you know, you got to combine all those things together. That's kind of the secret sauce in a long, drawn-out answer.
Okay. So, I mean, and by weapons manipulation, as far as, like, presentations from the holster, stuff like that, that you can do dry?
Absolutely. And, I'll use me as an example. A lot of guys are under the impression that I practice all the time and that I'm just like this training machine, and I'll be quite honest with you, I am a better shooter now than I've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And I practice less than I ever have.
Right.
And a lot of that has to do with the manipulation. A lot of guys listening to this broadcast know what I'm talking about. I mean, if I'm wearing the same holster and the same gun all the time,
right,
I don't, and the same piece of clothing, my concealed draw is not going to change that very much. I've just got to burn maybe 10 good reps, and I'm tight on that. You know what I mean?
Right.
And, that's kind of where you got to go with it. I mean, but dry practice, I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot. Mindset is a huge part of it. Like I said, you know, bringing that adrenaline dump into it. And, you know, one thing we found out early on was that a lot of guys, a lot of high-end law enforcement agencies, a lot of the SOCOM units that I touch, they overtrain in shooting very similar to how they overtrained physically, you know, 10 years ago,
okay,
15 years ago.
Damn.
And once we kind of changed that a little bit and took more of the physical application, where you know, some of the theory is, you know, 50% of your success is recovery. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you know, you guys have seen it, I know, and people that are listening to this thing know. You see a guy who practices his draw over and over and over and over and over and over, and then you go out to the range and he's like either the same time as you or maybe slower, and you're
right,
like, how does that happen? It's because he's not doing it correctly. You know what I mean?
Well, and that actually brings an interesting point up that I'd kind of like to get your take on. We got about 3.5 minutes left, and we're talking with Kyle DeFour from DeFour Performance Shooting. As far as consistency in carry gear, and I know a lot of guys that will carry one or two or three or four or five different kinds of gun, and by different I don't mean like a Glock 19 and a Glock 26 and a Glock 17, depending on mode of dress, but like completely different platforms, and then they'll carry it like in different holsters because of the different platforms. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely no go. I mean, you're not a, you know, I mean, and I'm not, again, this is not me talking, like this is Kyle's, like, you know, my method of madness. I'm telling you, you know, this is, you know, the experience that I see out on my line.
Yeah.
You have to pick. It's like I tell guys with AR-15s or M4s, the problem now is that there's too many options.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. You know, back when I first came in the SEAL teams, you know, you got a Colt Model 727, and that was it. You know, and after your first deployment, you could hose clamp a mag light onto it. Now, on your second deployment, you might get an ACOG or an aim point if there was one available. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so that's the problem. And it's the same with gear. You know, there's like every other week there's a new crew making an appendix carry holster. And, you know, guys are like, well, I'm going to try this. You know, that holster's not going to make you any faster, man.
Yeah.
Within reason. I mean, we all know the quality companies. I mean,
right,
you know, don't have a leather holster and don't have any, you know, craziness on the inside, you know, Kydex or plastic, nice and fast. I mean, it tucks in good. I mean, that's it. You pick one holster, pick one gun, and go train your ass off. That's what you need to do,
right,
period.
I was just kind of curious because, like I said, I know a lot of guys that, And I guess it's a difference, too. Do you think it's a difference between, like, a collector and someone that's more self-defense-minded?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely. I see it all the time. You know, I see guys in open enrollment classes, and dudes will be like, you know, first day, we'll be back at 25. They're shooting their 1911, you know.
Right.
That somewhat works, you know.
Right.
And then they're like, well, we go up close now. We're at 7. And then they're like, well, I'm going to switch to my Glock 19 with my Glock Works trigger and my red dot.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm like, which, I mean, that's fine. Hey, if that's your gig, rock on. I don't care. I mean,
right.
I don't say anything to anybody. But, you know, I do have a special place in my heart for the dude who I see on the end of the line who's, you know, he's a college. He's still paying student loans, and
right.
he's got holes in his blue jeans. This
right.
dude's got one holster that's worn the hell out.
Right.
And he's got a gun that has been drawn so many times that, you know, it looks like Boba Fett's body armor.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, and I'm like, yeah, and that dude is crushing everybody.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's – I had this conversation with Claude Werner, and then we'll have to go to break. He interviewed me when I was out at SHOT Show, but I only own one handgun right now. I own two, but then I donated one of them for some reason. I don't know why I did that, but, like, it, as far as – you know, that's kind of where I'm at is just picking one thing, and it makes it real easy to pick one thing when you force yourself to only have one thing.
Yeah, know? Absolutely. Simplicity, man. I mean, the simpler things are, the richer the experience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I'm saying? A friend of mine that's a very famous climber said that, and, you know, that is true in every facet of life.
Right. Cool. Well, we'll talk about that some more, and I actually want to discuss the new trend towards variable power optics, but we got to go to break. When we get back, we'll be talking a little bit more with Kyle about those things. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. Right now, we are talking with a different Kyle, Mr. Kyle DeFore from DeFore Performance Shooting. So, we were just making all the 1911 people out there pretty angry, it sounds like, Kyle.
yeah, there'll be like some hate calls. Like,
that's all right.
Hey, there is one dude that I've shot with. He's come to like four or five of my classes. He actually has the only 1911, I swear to God. He's got the only 1911 that actually runs without malfunctioning during my class.
You know,
I told him that, you know, just keep coming, dude. You can just come whenever you want.
No, it's funny. I'll hook you up with a guy that's going to want to come shoot with you anyway. But he's got the 20 or 30 1911s that all run, all of them. But, you know, he's an engineer, too, so I would hope they all run. Anyway, sorry, Bill, just making a joke. He listens to the show, too. So, anyway, if you would like to call in, you can get a hold of us at 513-749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. We will try and take your calls at the end of the show, but moving forward, variable power optics. What are your thoughts on those? Those seem to kind of be moving into a larger place in the industry, and I was curious as to what you had to say about those.
I mean, I'll tell you right now. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe because this is radio and it's nationwide or whatever, maybe I'm making a huge mistake here, but. Let me caveat it with this. A few years ago, I got interviewed by a dude, and he was asking me about, you know, rifles and accuracy and whatever. And I said, look, man, I said, bolt guns are going out to pasture. Just stand by. And, you know, he kind of laughed at me a little bit, made fun of me, kind of made me look, you know, a little bad. And,
yeah.
And the next one calendar year later, a very good friend of mine from third group down in Fort Bragg, him and his spotter won the international sniper comp with a LaRue OBR.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying, again, I don't really have a dog in the fight for the most part. I mean, I helped.
You're just saying that guy was wrong and you were right, na-na-na-na.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like, you know, hey, dude,
okay.
go write your magazine article. We'll stick to the training piece. But, I mean, in all seriousness, one thing about this industry, and you guys know this, everybody knows it, you know, people are really, when stuff comes in, I mean, look at the appendix carry rig, you know, when that came in, people are like, oh, my God, you know, whatever.
And that's actually interesting because if you think of how long that's been around.
Long time.
Oh, my God, you know, guys were doing it, you know.
60s and 70s.
Quote, unquote, SOCOM guys were doing it, you know, in Vietnam. I mean, it just, it's. But when it gained attention with the internet and people are like, oh, you're pointing the gun at your femoral, it's like, hey, but yeah, but if you're out of shape and you're wearing it at 3 o'clock, you're pointing it at the back of your thigh. I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, but yeah, I mean, the variable power thing, here's what I'll say, you know, the reason for all that, I'm telling you now, within a few years, it's going to, there aren't going to be any red dots per se anymore. And I say that because of what I've done with U.S. Optics. I mean, if they're willing to listen and do what we've done, then that means Leopold's going to do it, and that means Smith & Bender's going to do it, and Knife Force is going to do it. Everybody's going to do it. And the price point is going to get down to where you're going to go, well, I'm spending $1,000 or $1,200 on a EOTech or an Aimpoint T1 with a magnifier behind it, when I can spend a few hundred more, and not only do I get all of that, but it's in one complete package, and by the way, it goes way more than 3 power. You know what I mean? So, I think it's the future. I mean, I helped with the 1-4 and the 1-8 with U.S. Optics. They're out right now. The 1-8 is available right now. Mm-hmm. It's the 1-4 will be available in probably another month or two. I have, I think, the only 2 or 3 that are around. You know, we put the red dot. It's a daytime visible red dot for I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. But basically, take an aim point. You know, it's a daytime visible red dot. It's on the second focal plane, so it doesn't change. You know, it's the same size the whole time.
Right.
And then on the first focal plane, you have a reticle. And there's a choice of reticles. They're all pretty cool. And I mean, that's the future, man. I mean, that is. And the biggest reason is for the military. And we've been fighting this problem since Somalia in 93 with, you know, with C Squadron. Guys have got to be able to PID, positively identify bad guys amongst good guys. And it doesn't matter the difference. It could be 50 yards. If you've got one bad dude in a huddle of good people, you got to be able to PID, and you got to be able to make the shot. And the only way you're doing that without – you got to have magnification. You can't do that naked eye.
Okay. And that actually brings us around to something else I wanted to talk about as far as target ID goes. I've been following several instances as of late where people have gotten shot, and you know, obviously I deal with more of the concealed carry crowd and that sort of, you know, the home defense sort. But I've noticed where people have gotten shot because people didn't have a white light or didn't positively identify a threat before you know, before they engaged it. I actually, I saw a conversation online where it was, you know, do you carry a flashlight? And this one guy's response was, well, this is my flashlight. And it was a picture of some tritium sights lit up. And I'm like, you really don't understand
exactly
what that's for.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people give me flack because the sights that I make with Ameriglow are solid black. And they're like, what, you know, what's up with that?
Yeah.
I mean, here's what's up with that. I mean, tritium sights, hey, if you're a cop, if you're a working man, what I call a working person, you're a cop or a military guy or something, do you need tritium sights? Hey, man, any advantage I can get. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, because here's, but let's everybody think logical order of thought here. Let's go reality. When do tritium sights actually help on a pistol? They help at dusk and they help at dawn when you can still positively ID the threat, but you wouldn't be able to pick up solid black sights. That's when they help.
Right.
So you're talking about total in a daytime, in a 24-hour span, a total of maybe 30 minutes that they help. Now, if you're a guy that, you know, that's when high crime statistics are for you, is that dusk and dawn, you know, yada, yada. But, I mean, solid black sights are going to be more accurate than the day. You need to carry, bottom line, whoever you are, if you're a tritium guy or a black sight guy, you have got to carry a flashlight to PID, man.
Right.
I mean, either on the gun or on your person.
Or both.
Or, yeah, a lot of guys do both. And I'll tell you, if you know, that's the thing. Your experienced cops will have a X300 or a TLR1 on the gun. And, of course, they've still got a crusher of a handheld because they know the deal.
Right.
And that's the way it's got to be, man.
For those of you that do not know the deal.
You know.
Yeah.
It's a correction implement.
something.
Yeah. I mean, oh, dude, flash. We do some stuff with flashlights, man. Oh my God.
Even when I was a security guard, they came in handy. Back right after high school. I can't tell the story. Never mind. Anyway, please continue.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think of a lot of it's a, it goes back to that kind of the gear thing, right?
Right.
Let's look at it. You know, if we go back in the day, let's go back to the New York City Stakeout Squad, Jim Cirillo. Let's go back to those days. Those guys are shooting revolvers, man. They're getting in a lot of gunfights.
Yep.
They do not have tritium sights.
And they win.
And they're winning. And, you know, these are the guys who, by the way, they're inventing the technique of using a flashlight.
Right.
You know what I mean? This would be the equivalent of my generation of guys with nods and lasers. You know, we kind of, we've you know, perfected that, but we got the real training, the real opportunity to use it. So, I mean, you've got to have if I had a choice, if people are like, hey, you can have tritium or black, you know, I'm going to go with black because if you use your handheld flashlight correctly or if you have a weapon-mounted light, the sights are backlit perfect to take a shot in complete darkness. So,
you know, that's a... And I'm actually really glad you brought up the 30 minutes of the day when they actually come in really useful, only because... And the other instance that I've run into is, like, if you're in a dark, dark place and you're shooting into a, you know, a much... more brightly lit place, they come in handy there.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But
and the biggest problem with tritiums is that, well, from what I've seen, you know, finding a set that's actually made correctly, and I'll give away the key here to the kingdom, but, you know, the tritium dot on the front sight, it has got to be at the highest point, midline of the front sight. It needs to be at the bottom is where it needs to be.
Right.
Bottom line. That way, when you're taking a daytime shot, you can still find the front top of the front sight post and actually hit a man's head at 25 with a pistol. You know?
Right. Well, you know, I think the other thing, too, is that maybe not enough people put the practice into really figuring out where their sights are hitting, which is a completely different conversation. Because, you know, I was running Trigicon HDs on that that Salient project or whatever that we just auctioned off, and Andy, you saw me, 45 yards, double action headshots?
Yeah, shot after shot. Now, I couldn't do it, but, you know. The sights, you know.
Well, here's the thing that the listeners can you can take this to the bank. You can carve this one in stone.
Yes.
When it comes to pistols, I don't care if it's a SIG or a Glock or an HK. Number one, if you get two Glock 17s off the line, there is a possibility. It doesn't mean it's going to happen all the time. But there's a possibility that one will shoot in one spot at 25 and one will shoot at another spot in 25, and that's if they were made right after each other. Right.
Yes.
So you got to realize that if you put the same sights on the gun, even if you use the four tactical sights from Ameriglow, you know, you're like, okay, that's what I'm using, and it's possible they're not going to hit right. It's just the way pistols are.
Yeah.
And what I tell guys is that the funny thing to me is that when we get to rifles, you know, there's adjustable everything, scopes, red dots, and iron sights, and everybody turns and twists and gets everything to where it needs to be, and then a lot of people assume a pistol, they're like, well, Glock knows what they're doing, or SIG knows what they're doing, or H&K knows. It's got to be good. You're like, dude, no. It's an 80% solution at best.
Right.
Generally, the sights suck. Generally, the barrels are, you know, you're 50-50 depending on the manufacturer. The grip, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, why is there a grip indent on a Glock pick? You know what I mean? Like, who puts their thumb right there, right?
Well, back, I guess when they were, and that's just interesting, too, is actually to have that conversation about leftover vestiges on pistols that haven't moved forward. But we're actually up on the break, so I got some more questions to ask you when we come back. Also, if you guys want to call in, you can get a hold of us if you're local, 513-749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. If you're listening in Arizona, well, don't call in because the show will have been over for an hour by the time you hear this. Anyway, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. Right now, we are talking with Mr. Kyle DeFore about all sorts of interesting things that will probably make people mad at some point once they listen to this, if we haven't already. But that's kind of the cool part of the show. If you would like to get on the line with us, you can get a hold of us, 1-800-823-8255. 513-749-5500. No one on the line right now that I want to talk to, no offense. So, you could still get a hold of us. Anyway, Kyle, are you still there?
Yes, sir.
So we were having an interesting conversation on the phone as I was driving back today, and I was curious to get your thoughts and or opinion about, you know, you went from a very high-speed unit, for lack of a better term, to kind of civilian lifestyle a little bit. I mean, not as much as most people do when they get out and, you know, rotate back into the world. How's that been for you, and what are your thoughts as far as the transition and the difficulty there?
It's there. I mean, it was hard for me. It was hard for me for a while, you know, because the place that I came from, we were so busy when I left that, you know, at first you get out, you know, but, and then you hear about some stuff the boys did, and you're like, damn.
Right.
You know, they got 30 dudes the other night. You're like, oh, my God, I could have been there, you know. And so then it's a little bit of like, damn it, you know, I'm missing out. And then it for me, it turned into, you know, I'm letting these guys down. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because I don't want to make it sound like something it's not. But, you know, where I came from, it is what I think a lot of people would think of maybe an old gangster movie or something. It's kind of for life. You know what I mean? Like, even if you're not there,
you're still there.
You're still talking to the boys and you know what's going on and you're working in some capacity, whether you're teaching shooting or whatever. So it was hard for me. You know, it got really hard for me a couple of years ago because, you know, that was just, you know, that was my crew. So, but I think the biggest thing for any guys, and I studied this a little bit with just on my own, just researching online and at Barnes & Noble or whatever. But if you go back in time, historically, modern day, when guys have come back from war, and I'm not trying to be a soapbox guy right now, but I'm talking about really infantry guys, like guys that are no crap, they're out there doing it.
Right.
And obviously the SOCOM guys fall under that. They have historically, since World War I, when they've come back, they've gotten into some pretty cool, whatever you're thinking is cool stuff, wild stuff, you know, exciting stuff. Because I think once you experience that kind of war, and especially when you look at it nowadays, where we're at 12 years now deployed, guys are not, they cannot come back, turn it off, and, like, just do barbecues and ball games. It's not going to happen. I mean, I don't care what kind of psychology degree you have, or what, it's not going to happen. If you want it to happen, bad things are going to happen because you can't put dudes into that. So for me personally, here's what I think, and again, I'm an uneducated person. I barely made it through high school, so but I think you need a daily outlet when you're coming back from this kind of thing, and that can be PT. It could be working out. It could be running. It could be riding motorcycles, you know, which I kind of hit two of those. I try to work out, and I generally ride my motorcycle everywhere. I think you need a daily outlet that is somewhat physical and can bring you back to a little bit of what you experienced there. And then I think you need a long-term outlet, which, you know, it needs to be goal-oriented. You know, what I started doing there early on was doing the ultra running, you know, like a 50-mile run or a 30-mile run or 32-mile run or whatever.
Right.
That seemed to be something where you're like, you know, this is not normal. Not everybody can do this.
Yeah.
You're kind of still in a special club, so to speak. So I think when guys come back that they, whether they're getting out retired at 20 years or they're getting out like me at 10 years, I think you need to, I wish somebody had told me that, hey, you know, have a daily outlet that you can do, have a long-term outlet that you know, maybe it's hunting. Maybe you want to go hunting for elk in Montana, or maybe you want to go to Africa and get a Cape Buffalo or whatever. That's your long-term deal, and your daily deal is your PT or your running, or, you know, maybe you ride a motorcycle and you try to touch 100 miles an hour every day on the interstate. I'm not recommending that unless your bike is set up correctly, by the way. but whatever it is. But, you know, you look at, I mean, hell, we've had biker gangs started post-World War, you know. We've had, you know, it's it,
If you look historically at a lot of who the, for lack of a better term, crazy dudes are, that you know, they come out of the military and they actually lead as close to normal life as you're able to after something like that, they tend to be adrenaline junkies a little mm-hmm. bit.
Now, I would say, you know, that would be the word I think a lot of people use. But, I mean, I would not say that I – it's calculated risk. I mean, I'm right. not going to go and you know, I just got back from a lead climber course out in Red Rocks. I mean, that's basically how we got everybody out to SHOT Show.
Right.
We did a military lead climber. I mean, dangerous, absolutely, because we're teaching guys to do it, you know, in a reduced rack, you know, non-locking carabiner, you know, whatever, just stuff they can find on the street from in whatever country. Is it dangerous? Absolutely it is, but we've trained so much on it, but that's the training and actually doing it is where we're kind of, quote-unquote, getting off, you know what I mean? You're like, it's all one big thing, you know? And
right.
But I would say for guys, man, you can't, I don't know, at least my friends, we've not been able to come back and just be like, okay, I'm done with that.
I'm going to get in the minivan and drive. Yeah.
Yep, not an assaulter anymore. Going to go be a greeter at Walmart. You know what I mean? That's not going to happen, dude.
Yeah.
I mean.
And I appreciate you talking about it, and the reason why I asked is because I've been talking with some other people that are friends of mine lately, and, you know, I've dealt with in my past dealing with friends of mine that didn't make the transition so well, and they're not around anymore. And whenever I can talk to guys that, you know, are willing to talk about that publicly, I think it's a good thing. And I know that, you know, the listenership, a lot of ex-military listening right now. So I appreciate you discussing
it. Well, if I can, you know, one thing that is mind-boggling to me is obviously the military suicide rate of OEF and OIF guys. And you know, it was the same in Vietnam, and it was the same in Korea, and it was the same in World War II. It's just that we didn't have the internet back then. We didn't have the close communication with each other and everybody that we have now.
Right.
It's always been the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tom Spooner, who's a friend of mine through J.D. Potensky at Invictus, you know, he's doing good things to try to, you know, help this thing. And I think a lot of people, man, that PTSD word is it is still to this day, because of Hollywood and the media, it's like this taboo thing. And
yeah.
I think what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, you've got PTSD if you were in a good bar fight. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like,
right.
It doesn't mean it's a bad deal. It doesn't even mean it's something that should prevent you from doing something. It's just that people have to realize that, you know, you're asking these guys to go over and do this thing. And then, because here's the deal. When 9/11 happened, I mean, I remember I was already at the command when it happened. You know, everybody wanted blood. I mean, I remember it crystal clear, you know, go over, send the boys over there and let's basically start killing people. And, but you know, how soon we forget and how short America's attention span is. And now it's like, hey, by the way, all those dudes that are now 40, you know, 45 that went over when they were 25 or 30 or whatever, you know, don't forget about them, dude, because they did exactly what you asked, because, you know, you weren't going to do it. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
like,
right.
And that's something a lot of people should keep in mind. I mean, it's, you know, again, that's a whole nother show, so I don't want to get sidebarred too much, but, you know.
Yeah,
you got to transition, man.
No, and you know, thanks. I really do appreciate you talking about it, only because, like I said, I don't think that it's openly discussed enough. And
for me as a civilian, it's hard for me to even get to that place to understand it. So I think you speaking about it helps people who may not have ever had that experience to have some idea what these guys are going through when they come back.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I think one of the things I was talking to some other dudes with is, you know, I think one of the biggest things besides PTSD is survivor's guilt, you know?
Yeah, and I would actually say that's the bigger of the two.
And I will tell you straight up, I mean, I've talked to my wife about it before. I mean, I had it wholeheartedly. I had there were five of us one day. We got hit with an IED, and one guy died. And, you know, I was at the time a single dude with three motorcycles that was in a specialized unit and, you know, whatever. And the dude that died was, you know, married with a six-month-old.
Yeah.
And so, anywho, a lot of that stuff, man, it, you know, you got to find an outlet for that, and that's the best way that I know of to deal with it. So hopefully I help some dudes out.
Well, hey, I really appreciate you coming on the show tonight, man, and I'll catch up with you off the air and all that. Thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem.
Great.
So next week we're going to be talking with Patrick McNamara about high-intensity training and some of the things that he's doing these days. I actually ran into him out in Las Vegas when I was there. But remember, you can always listen to past shows, ballisticradio.com, and check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/ballisticradio. I give stuff away there. Anyway, make sure you tune in next Sunday, 7 p.m. Thank you for listening to Ballistic Radio. Be safe.